created how loving, warm, and welcoming the next world is, and how we shouldn't be afraid. The reason this made such an impact on me is on my way back to California, I was told my stepfather was in the ICU. I flew to where he was and felt better that I was able to help him into the next world, and that messages received during my ayahuasca ceremonies were designed to help me help him. I was so grateful for this experience. Ernesto, I wanted to end on a quote from your book. You, after a psychedelic vision, you wrote, "We heal when we make peace with the thoughts that torment us. It takes practice to disarm them, to let them be, but quieter, gentler, until they are no more." And that is exactly what we are here on Earth to do. We're here to practice. How is your practice going in the last 30 seconds of our show?
Yeah, well, you know, some people often ask me, you know, has this cured your depression? And I think I will always feel something of a gravitational pull toward depression. But I think I've become a lot better at making room for depression and of existing with my thoughts in a way that is healthier.
May that continue for you. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've been talking to New York Times reporter Ernesto Londoño about his new book, Trippy, The Peril and Promise of Medicinal Psychedelics. I will say I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful weaving of memoir and really well-done reporting. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum ahead with Mina Kim. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Right now on Monday morning, it's Elaine Leung with a look at traffic starting along the peninsula.
Good morning, Dave. It was in Menlo Park, the scene of a crash. South 101 heading for Marsh Road. Well, excellent news. That is completely gone. However, pretty slow heading out of San Carlos from Holly Street. Still some heavy traffic westbound 205 through Tracy and on to the Altamont Pass. Bay Bridge, the lights are on. Heavy at the toll plaza, then traffic from the incline into the city. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Monday morning traffic support comes to us from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from Comcast Business in partnership with Extreme Networks, presenting the first professional sports venue to be Wi-Fi 6E ready with hundreds of access points throughout Oracle Park. business.comcast.com/community. And you're listening to community-supported KQED FM 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI FM 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento, live online at kqed.org. 10 o'clock.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Nina Kim. Coming up on Forum, having a former president running for the White House as a convicted felon has added a new narrative to the presidential election, one that should be a liability for Republicans, but could also prove tricky for Democrats to navigate. MSNBC host Jen Psaki knows tricky and consequential communication moments well as Biden's former press secretary, White House communications director under Obama, and State Department spokesperson under Kerry. We'll talk with Psaki about what she's learned from communicating with a divided electorate, a president, and a preschooler. Her new book is Say More, Lessons from Work, the White House, and the World.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Former President Donald Trump is calling on the U.S. Supreme Court to take up his case after he was convicted of 34 felony counts in his hush money trial. NPR's Frank Ordonez reports on how Trump is pushing back after the verdict.
The former president took to social media and cable news where he criticized the verdict as biased against him. In a friendly interview with Fox News, Trump repeated many of his complaints about the trial and the judge while painting himself as a political victim.
I talk about the enemy on the outside and the enemy from within. Say you have Russia, you have China, but if you have a smart president, you always handle him. Quite easily, actually. We have a lot of advantages. But the enemy from within, they are doing damage to this country.
Trump's legal team has vowed to appeal his conviction, but he's also calling on the country's highest court to intervene, posting on his social media website, quote, "The United States Supreme Court must decide." Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
President Biden's son Hunter is on trial on federal gun charges in Delaware. First Lady Jill Biden accompanied her stepson to court this morning for jury selection. Dr. Anthony Fauci is flatly rejecting GOP allegations that he sought to cover up the possibility that the coronavirus originated in a Chinese lab.
The accusation being circulated that I influenced these scientists to change their minds by bribing them with millions of dollars in grant money is absolutely false and simply preposterous.
The former head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, in a tense exchange with Republican members of a House panel looking at the U.S. response to the pandemic. Fauci's critics accuse him and others of overstepping their authority and orchestrating a strict response of closures, masking, and distancing mandates. President Biden has outlined a three-phase plan to end Israel's war in Gaza. The plan has yet to be formally agreed to by Hamas or Israel. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf tells us, civilians in Gaza are eager to see Biden push through the deal.
The plan includes a six-week ceasefire and the possibility for Palestinians displaced from North Gaza to go back home for the first time in the war. NPR producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, spoke with Rima Alaka, a mother of four currently living in a tent in Mawasi near Rafah in southern Gaza. It's a difficult life, she says, but she's hopeful about the possibility of being able to go home.
Actually, this is a dream for us, actually, to just return to our houses in the north of Gaza and to stop the war, actually, the fighting, all these things, because our bodies are very, very tired, you know, and our dream right now, actually, to stop the war and this hard life. So I hope America to do that and stop the war.
Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. California's largest wildfire of the year ignited over the weekend on the east edge of the Bay Area. The Corral Fire near Tracy started Saturday afternoon amid strong winds. By that night, it had pushed people from their homes and injured two firefighters. Since then, though, the situation has eased. State fire officials announced this morning the fire, which has burned 14,000 acres and at least one home, is now 75% contained. All of that region's evacuation orders have been downgraded to warnings, and Interstate 580, which had been closed in the area, reopened. KQED's Catherine Monahan reports from Tracy.
Travis Curtis is sitting in a gas station parking lot with other evacuees. It's the last stop before a roadblock, and on the other side is whatever remains of his parents' house.
We're waiting to get the clearance to be able to go in and, you know, basically rip off the Band-Aid and see how bad it is. But from what we've been told, there's the foundation, and that is it.
Police ordered over 200 households to evacuate Saturday. Curtis says his parents left with only their tortoise, two dogs, and a bag of clothes. They're hoping their insurance can arrange housing for them while they decide whether to rebuild. In Tracy, I'm Catherine Monahan, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more on Catherine's story at kqed.org.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And the listeners and members of KQED Public Radio. Bay Area today, mostly cloudy to partly cloudy skies. The coolest day, mid-60s to the mid-80s inland. It gets hot tomorrow. Heat advisory starts at 8 o'clock officially for the Bay Area. Look for temperatures tomorrow, mid-60s to the upper 90s far inland. Cloudy skies today around Sacramento, also cool, relatively cool today. Highs 80 to 88. Tomorrow, hot weather in the forecast, mostly clear skies. Warm to hot, temperatures 98 to 104, and excessive heat warning starts tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. for the Sacramento Valley.
I'm Mina Kim. When Jen Psaki became White House press secretary for President Biden, she inherited a role that had become a punchline for exaggerating crowd sizes and sparring with reporters over basic facts.
In her debut book, Say More, Psaki shares how she set a new tone in the briefing room and used her back and forth with Fox reporters to her advantage. Good communication strategies are applicable to a wide range of life experiences, Psaki writes. Whether you're a parent talking to a teacher about your preschooler, a friend trying to encourage a coworker to take a risk, or a young female staffer trying to convince the most powerful man in the world that what he might want to include in his State of the Union address. We'll also get Psaki's thoughts on how to talk about an opposing candidate who's a convicted felon. The MSNBC host of Inside with Jen Psaki joins me now. Jen, so great to have you on Forum.
It's great to be here with you, Mina. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, really glad to have you. Can you start by telling the story of trying to talk with your then 5-year-old about taking the job as Biden's press secretary? Because you really prepared ahead of time for that, right?
I did. I'm a bit of a prepper, which I think anyone who knows me or who reads the book will know. But when I was going back to the White House to work for President Biden, I had not done the campaign. I'd worked on the transition. And I knew, because I'd worked in the White House before, that when you decide to work there, you're going full in. You're available 24 hours a day. And I knew that that would, of course, have a huge impact on my family. And so because my daughter was 5 at the time, what I did was I took her out to frozen yogurt at a place called Sweet Frog, where you can kind of mix many different flavors. People, 5-year-olds often pick things like cotton candy and cookies and cream and put them in one box, you know, one cup together, which is gross, but she loves the place. And I had prepared in advance. I thought to myself, I'm going to make this a moment where I really teach her about patriotism and public service. And so I'd written out what I wanted to say, and I sat down with her. She had her frozen yogurt, and I said, "So, Vivi, you know that nice man who won the election, Joe Biden?" She said, "Yeah, I know that's a funny way to describe an incoming president," but she was 5 at the time. And I said, "Well, he's asked me to come help him for a while. And what that means is that I'm going to have to be working. I'll work a lot. I'll work more time, and I'll have more time away from you. And that's going to be a big sacrifice. And it also means that it's a sacrifice for you." And I felt pretty proud of myself in the moment. I thought, oh, I'm really teaching her something here. And I said to her, "Does that make sense?" She took a big, you know, bite of her ice cream or her frozen yogurt. And she said, "No, Mom." So the point is, I learned from that, and there are many other times in my career, and certainly as a mother, that I've had moments where you think, I've thought about how to communicate, and then it just doesn't land. And what I learned from that was that it's not always about the words, that sometimes and oftentimes it's about how you make people feel. And I tell the story in the book about how it was not until about 9 or 10 months later that my daughter and my son, who's a couple years younger than my daughter, came to the White House for the turkey pardon. And it was their first time to the White House when I was the press secretary because of COVID. And so they met the president. They saw the big turkeys who sleep in a hotel the night before, which they thought was funny. I took them to the White House mess where you can order food at a counter. And my daughter tried Sprite for the first time from a huge soda machine. They saw a lot. They saw my office, the briefing room, and as we were walking out, someone from the First Lady's office, who was overseeing events, gave them each a pack of cookies, Thanksgiving cookies, and said, "These are from the president. He wanted you to have them." And of course, when we get in the car, I said, "Vivi, what was the best thing about today? I mean, was it meeting the president? Was it seeing my office? Was it seeing where, you know, the Today Show, where people do hits for the Today Show or interviews for the Today Show?" And she said, "I love Sprite, Mom. I learned that. And the president sure does make good cookies." But after that, she kind of had a good feeling about me working in the White House. So the point is, sometimes it's about how you make people feel and less about the words that you spit out at them.
Yeah, you quote Maya Angelou in the book saying people remember how you feel, how you made them feel more than what you say. Improving the feel of the briefing room, I know, was something that was very important to you and President Biden. I think he said lower the temperature in that room. First, Jen, how would you characterize the tone of the briefing room and the reputation of the role of press secretary that was left by the previous administration?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I knew coming into the job was that the briefing room had become a forum for lies, for attacks on the press. Not every day, but far too frequent for it to be acceptable. It shouldn't be the bar ever. And it had become a very venomous place. And I say venomous and not contentious because the briefing room can be contentious. Debate is a part of our democracy. The reporters pushing the press secretary, as they pushed me, is a part of what should happen in there. That is their job, the freedom of the press, but the role as the people of requesting information on behalf of the American public. But it had really taken a turn where the media had been treated as the villain and the opponent, as opposed to kind of a part of what any White House and any president would recognize as part of our democracy. So I knew that obviously it was incumbent upon me to be up to speed and up to date and be very knowledgeable about the issues and the policies that the White House and the president was presenting. But it was also important for me and important to the president in our first conversation, he conveyed this to me about the job, to take the venom out of the room, to take the temperature down, as you said, because it had become a forum not for providing information, but for, very vitriolic kind of attacks.
It's a unique position to be in, given the fact that you had just followed the Trump administration. So how did you go about resetting that in that way, lowering the temperature, taking out the venom?
Well, part of it was things as simple as calling on a range of people in the room. Now, you never call on, you can never get to everybody in the room because you run out of time. But what I mean by that is, you know, Fox News is often thought of as an opponent of Democratic presidents and Democratic candidates and other things. And I called on Fox News every day because part of it was sending the message that we were going to take questions from a range of people and a range of outlets, even if they were critical of the president. The other part was just the tone. And it wasn't that, and certainly I had imperfect moments for sure, many of them, and I write about them in the book and on a chapter on mistakes, all about mistakes. But, part of it was also the tone and the tone of not yelling back at a reporter for asking a tough or repetitive question, but providing the information you had and trying not to make it a forum for debate is okay, but not crossing the line. The other piece of it is, I think it became a place where people would, not everybody, but some would speechify in there a bit. And this happened when I was at the State Department too, and there it was, more often than not, when this happened, it was kind of individuals from state-run media, from China or Russia or other places, where they would kind of pontificate and share things that were not based in fact. And so part of it was, well, we didn't want it to be, and the president didn't want it to be a room where it was attacking the press, was also cutting off the sharing of disinformation if that came up, and on occasion it did. So it was kind of a range of things, but the big part of it was calling on a range of people and also kind of the tone that you had the debate through.
Yeah, I was struck also by the fact that you sort of, I think, almost reframe those interactions in a way where you thought of them as opportunities for people who needed the administration's perspective, facts about whatever piece of legislation, to be able to push back on the kind of conservative argument that maybe a Peter Ducey was putting forward in the briefing room, which was an interesting reframing, which I imagine must have also changed even your whole demeanor in that interaction.
Correct. Yes. In part because it's not that part of, and I talk about this in the book, is it's not always about winning the argument. It's about meaning with more words or louder tone or saying the last thing. It's about cracking the door open or providing context or information to people who may want to make the argument you're making. So if there was a particular question from Peter or Fox or kind of another outlet where it was posed in a framing that was critical of the administration, I still saw it as an opportunity to provide the counter argument. Not because you're going to win over everybody who is watching a range of outlets that attack the president constantly, but because you want to equip people watching, or even watching clips of it, with the tools and the facts and the details to be able to have those discussions and arguments themselves. Not necessarily arguments, but, you know, like if somebody is raising an issue about whatever it may be, I mean, anything about COVID at the time, that was, of course, a big topic. Or there was a period of time where the Keystone Pipeline was a big topic, and being able to provide the facts to equip people listening.
Yeah, we're coming up on a break, but I did want to ask you about the unusual nature of doing a press conference on Inauguration Day.
Yes. So this was something, it may have been done before, not that we knew of at the time, but we made a conscious decision during the transition that we wanted to do a press conference on Inauguration Day. This is significant because typically it's the next day or even a couple days later as the whole team is getting settled into being in the White House. And you don't get into the White House until noon on Inauguration Day. So I don't even know if I probably did log into my computer, but barely on the first day when I did the first briefing. And we wanted to send the message by doing that we were kind of bringing the regularity of the briefings and the briefings as a forum for asking tough questions and providing information to the public, especially at a time where we were following an administration that did not have that same value, and also at a time where people of all political parties and persuasions were looking for information about COVID.
Yeah. Also, you were just following an insurrection. I'm wondering, listeners,
correct,
if you remember.
Yes, it was just 2 weeks after. So all of that, I mean, it was incredibly, the nerves of the country were raw. Washington, D.C. was locked down. We were all wearing masks. There were so many questions people had that were, many of them, beyond politics.
Yeah, incredible. Let me ask, listeners, do you remember that first press conference? Stay with us for more with Jen Psaki after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for KQED comes from Hassler Heating and AC, advancing California's electric initiatives by converting homes to heat pump technology. For installation or repair of heating and cooling equipment, visit HasslerHeating.com. KQED Live presents a night of contemporary jazz music and a look at the local scene live on stage with the podcast Right Nowish, June 20th, 7 p.m. Tickets at kqed.org/live, supported by SF MoMA.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Wildfires on the island of Maui last year destroyed the homes of 4,000 families. So what if short-term vacation rentals were converted into long-term housing?
The overwhelming number of them, about 90% of them, are owned by people who don't live in Hawaii. So this is what's underpinned, you know, the activists.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us for the topic and more on Here and Now, along with the latest news, 11 to 1 today.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour with MSNBC host of Inside with Jen Psaki and former White House press secretary under President Biden. Jen Psaki served as White House press secretary until May of 2022, and she's written a new book all about the life lessons and effective communication strategies that she's learned from having to engage with presidents, the American people, and also with her preschool kids. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. What do you want to ask Jen Psaki about effective communication strategies in all kinds of situations? What questions do you have about the dynamics of the presidential race now after Trump's conviction, and also with all the other issues that are swirling about? What have you learned from a successful communication moment you've had, or maybe a communication mistake that you've made that you'd like to share? You can email forum at kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. We're on X, Instagram, our digital community on Discord. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And a listener on Discord writes, I am constantly impressed by Jen Psaki. Her time at the White House reminded me of the fictional character CJ Craig from the West Wing TV show. Have you heard that before, Jen? Are you a fan?
I am such a fan, and it's so funny because I did not watch The West Wing growing up, or whenever it first came out, But it actually was the motivator for me going back into government, because after I left in 2011, after I left the Obama administration, I was a consultant. I was a terrible consultant. I just was not good at the job. But I watched the entire series of The West Wing, and I thought to myself, I have to go back. So it was a big motivator for me to go work on the Obama re-election campaign in 2012.
Wow. What is the biggest difference between working with Obama and for Obama and working with President Biden? How are the two men different, the biggest difference, I guess?
Oh, they're so different. You know, one, I would say, I think that I worked for President Obama for 10 years, and the perception of him is often that he is an extrovert because he's such a phenomenal speaker. I mean, his speech at the 2004 convention was what made me excited about working for him one day if he ever ran for president, and I was certainly not alone. And the way he talks about things is so engaging, and he certainly feeds off of crowds. But he also gains his energy. I mean, an extrovert is not better than an introvert, right? An introvert, he gains his energy from being alone and being with his thoughts and reading broadly and widely. I mean, he reads everything from history to science fiction to fiction. That is who he is. President Biden is the opposite in that I've never met anyone more extroverted than him in terms of how he gains energy. He just loves being around people, and that's true when he's traveling. I mean, it is so endearing, but it's also exhausting because he always wants to be chatting with members of Congress or traveling staff or whomever it may be. And actually, at a point where he seemed to be tiring of doing day trips in the early months of the presidency, or maybe it was the first year, we decided that the best thing we could do was bring people who were elected officials along with him, because he could hang out with them and talk to them in between events. And sure enough, it gave him kind of an extra pep in his step, because he loved being around people and storytelling so much. So that's a big difference between them.
Yeah. Jen, how would you evaluate former President Trump as a communicator?
You know, I mean, there's no secret of my view of this, so I'll just say, I mean, I think his rhetoric is incredibly dangerous now, and it has been for years. I just want to start there. But his message is effective for a couple of reasons. One is it's been consistent. I mean, he's essentially been running the same way since he came up that escalator in 2015. And part of it is that he is the person who is attacked. He is the victim. He wants to dismantle the system. And there is a huge swath of people out there who connect with that, who feel angry with the system and disgusted by institutions. And he's tapping into that. Now, he doesn't care, in my view, about those people, right? He cares about himself. But there is an emotional tie. There's an emotional pull of his connection, of his message, that I think works to connect with people.
Yeah. Constantly reminding and constructing a narrative in which he is essentially the victim and there are forces out to get him, which is, of course, what he employed in the aftermath of the guilty verdict and his 34 convictions. But
correct.
I was curious what you thought about his press conference the next day, because he seemed more scattered and meandering. And I was wondering how significant the way he handles himself could be, maybe in the eyes of a swing voter, like if he appears affected by it, if that in some way weakens his stature.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, and I don't know that we know the answer yet, because there have been a number of public events in recent months where he has been kind of meandering off topic, all over the place. Yes, he has some of that kind of dangerous rhetoric where he, you know, characterizes himself as the victim, but it also is all over the place and inaccurate at times, and many times, but it doesn't seem to have impacted his base of supporters. I think there is a question if he's out there doing more political events and more rallies and talking more, which he has not done for the last 6 weeks to 2 months because of the trial, do people look and think, that is not an okay person? Unclear. We don't know yet. What I thought was most concerning about the day since the verdict is not just him, but a number of his supporters, and I mean prominent members of the Republican Party, I mean, Mike Johnson, I don't know if Byron Donalds is prominent, but he's been out there on television a fair amount. Mike Johnson is, of course, the Speaker of the House, have been out there, people who want to be the vice president, Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio, echoing his rhetoric, and even attacking the jury, the judge, people who are everyday citizens participating in the process. That's the kind of rhetoric that enables him and also enables the rising level of violence that we've seen. And that, to me, I hope that's of concern to people. I don't know. But his reaction in the last couple of days has been not surprising, but quite concerning.
Yes, and even on your show, you pointed out last night that Susan Collins was echoing the idea that the case was brought only because Trump was the defendant and no specified charges and all the kinds of things that he was posting on Truth Social. So it's really looking at the enablers and how they respond, and it sounds like the way they're responding is definitely very concerning to you.
Yes, yes.
Well, Laura writes, I had forgotten how difficult times were in January 2021 and what a relief it was to have someone like Jen Psaki represent a new administration, which we could trust held the national and people's interests in mind, unlike the previous 4 years of chaos and misinformation. And Peter writes, I remember crying with relief when Jen Psaki held her first press conference. My faith in government was restored. As we talked about, just the types of things that you were carrying on your shoulders that day as a result of the effect left by the previous administration. Let me bring Chris from Santa Clara into the conversation. And again, that number 866-733-6786, our social channels at KQED Forum, our email address forum@kqed.org. Chris in Santa Clara, you're on.
Hey, thanks, Mina. Jen, in the 2020 election, you know, at least best as I can tell, that if it had only been the votes of straight white men who were counted, I think Trump would have been reelected 535-3 in the Electoral College. Even in Delaware, numbers look like that demographic voted to reelect Trump. So my question for you is, given the demographic changes that have taken place in the country over recent decades, how can the White House or, you know, any type of, you know, federal administration be sure it kind of has a bifurcated, like a two-part communication strategy that actively embraces multilingual and multicultural communication to a group that's now effectively the majority?
What an interesting question. Great hearing your question, Chris, and I hope I'm understanding the question correctly. One thing I'll say that I think is interesting about where things are sitting right now in 2024, and we don't know what the outcome will be until we know what the outcome is that there are some demographic potential shifts or sort of some shifts in party alignment, and we'll see if this is what happens. And what it's looking like is less about, well, there are some demographic shifts. There are currently, President Biden is underperforming among African Americans and Latinos, and Trump is seeming to appeal to some small percentage that he didn't have before of both populations. We'll see if that sticks. The other place where there's this interesting potential realignment, and again, we'll see, we still have several months to go here, is around people who are college educated versus those who are not. And it is a big educational divide, which is what we're kind of seeing demographically in terms of who's aligning with each party. I think if you're asking me kind of, I don't know that it would have been 535-0 or whatever you may have said it was, but it is true that one, Trump did far better among white voters than Biden did, including white women as well, which I think is surprising given a range of factors. But that was true. What may be interesting to see this year is what the impact too is of Dobbs, which Dobbs had not been overturned pre-2020. I think that's kind of an undervalued factor leading into 2024. It shouldn't be undervalued because it's been a big factor in special elections and in 2022. But I think it's still maybe in terms of the percentage of people who might be excited about it, not because it's the top one issue, but because it may engage people who might otherwise not want to be engaged. But to go to your larger question, I think part of it is kind of how you govern and if you want to govern as somebody who's representing all people or not. It doesn't mean that everybody is going to follow you just because you want to be the leader of all, and certainly they have not followed President Biden. But President Biden is not somebody who's running for president as the person who's trying to divide the country, whereas I think
For Trump, that's quite different. Hmm. What you just have to do as president is recognize you're not going to win. There's never going to be another, in my view, Reagan-Mondale election where it's like such an overwhelming victory that one candidate wins one state. So we're not looking at that. Anybody who's going to govern in the future for the coming decades, I think, is going to be governing a divided country. So I think it's how you approach that and what your message is to the country about how you want to represent all of their interests and not just those who elected you.
Jen, what does the Biden campaign and Democrats, what do they have to weigh in terms of how much they make the issue of Trump, just himself, but also his felony conviction, a part of their reelection efforts?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always going to be central in part because as President Biden, and many people say this, not just him, but it is kind of a good summary of what elections are. It's the don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. And every election is about trying to win more votes than the person you're running against, not about presenting yourself as perfect because nobody is. So for the Biden team, you know, if the election is a referendum on Trump, that is good for them. Because it will empower and engage the Democratic base, some of whom aren't overly excited right now about voting. So that is sort of in their interest. Now, you still have to present an alternative to that, right? What are you going to do and present that is better than what the other guy in this case is presenting? I think the criminal cases and the conviction specifically, this has never happened in history before, and it's certainly part of who the Trump is, and part of who, and it is unquestionably better not to run as president as a convicted felon as opposed to the alternative. There's no question about that. For the Biden team, I think a lesson for them is to look back, and I think they're thinking about this at 2016, where Hillary Clinton ran against the character of Trump, kind of understandably, there was a lot to work with there. But in some ways, it didn't connect to how those character massive flaws were impacting people's lives. So it's like, how can you connect? Why is it a problem? This is kind of an obvious question as I pose it, but they need to make this connection for the public. How does it impact the average person out there that an option for the presidency is a guy who's been, you know, twice impeached, four times indicted, and also now convicted of a range of crimes? What does that mean? What does that mean for the type of president he would be for you and the things you care about? It's not just the criminality of it. It has to be connecting it back to people and their message.
Yeah. What's the hardest message you had to deliver to Biden while you were press secretary?
You know, there were a number of hard times. of hard times. I think I talk about in my book. A time when. During the drawdown in Afghanistan, when there were men and women who had served our country who lost their lives during an attack on Abbey Gate, and the president had gone to meet their bodies at Dover, and a number of the family members had been there, and the way he relates to people when they're going through loss is to talk about his own loss. And that is very effective with some, but not with everybody. And a number of these families, and it is their right to feel this way, had conveyed publicly that they didn't appreciate that he brought up his son in the conversations. And there was a story that was being written about it. I had to call him on a Saturday morning, I remember, and tell him that the number of these family members were in the story on the record conveying basically that they didn't appreciate that he'd brought up his own son. And that's a hard message to deliver, not having anything to do with the right of these family members to feel however they want to feel, of course, in that moment, but more because anytime you're working for somebody, whether it's a president or a CEO or anyone, conveying to them something that's personal is harder than telling them this bill isn't going to get passed. That's not easy, but messages or conversations about family, about how things are being perceived personally, I think are much more difficult, but they're still incumbent upon you to deliver.
Yeah. And you just basically did it in a pretty straightforward way, right? And he handled it well, it sounds like.
Yeah, I called him and I said, sir, that the New York Times is writing this story and I wanted you to be aware of it before it comes out. And I wanted you to know how we have handled it and make sure it's aligned with how you'd like us to handle it. And I basically told him what some of the families were quoted as saying in the story. And he went quiet on the line for a little bit. And I wondered, did I lose him? Is he still there? And I said, sir, are you still there? Are you still there? And he said, yeah, I thought I was helping them. Meaning, I'm not mad at them. I'm not taking issue with how they feel. He knows what it's like to lose, to experience loss more than most people. And it was more about him in the moment digesting the fact that he had not helped them and he had not been there for them in the moment as he had intended.
Yeah. We are coming up on a break, but I did want to ask you just how it's been for you now to talk about this administration that you worked for, to critique the administration as an MSNBC host, knowing what you know, the respect you clearly have for your former boss. How have you navigated that?
You know, I think about it off. I thought about it even more when I first started because I really wanted to do my best to do it right. And by right, I mean be able to offer the unique insight I have having worked for this administration and having been around the current president a fair amount to have an understanding broadly of how he views things and thinks about things and digests things. But also not being somebody who was applauding everything they did when not warranted. There are moments when it warrants applause. I thought his State of the Union was very strong and powerful. There are moments when I think they could have handled things differently and better, and I've said that. And so I try to be honest with myself and, of course, with the audience about what my view is, while also still not holding back and sharing insights when I think it would be useful to viewers.
Mm. It's very much sort of the theme of the book, which is Say More, Lessons from Work, the White House and the World. We have Jen Psaki with us, host of Inside with Jen Psaki on MSNBC, and of course, former White House press secretary under Biden. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Guy Marzorati, California Republicans may lack political power in Sacramento, but in recent years, they've made inroads on local school boards. Now, some of those conservative officials are facing recall elections, including in Riverside County and the Bay Area. We'll look at what's behind the recalls and what they say about the volatile politics of public education in our state. Listen to past Forum shows by going to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. We're talking with Jen Psaki this hour on Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Jen Psaki is, of course, former White House press secretary under President Biden and host of Inside with Jen Psaki. You, our listeners, are sharing your questions and comments as well at 866-733-6786, at the email address forum@kqed.org, on our social channels, on X, Instagram, our digital community, on Discord. And Anna Marie writes, how much preparation did you do as press secretary to be able to speak intelligently on so many topics? How did you prepare?
Jen? Maria, I would say every day. Oh, can you still hear me?
Yes. I can.
I would say every day I was not as intelligent as I would like. Every day I would end the briefing and think, I wish I would have said this other thing. So let me start there. But what I would typically do is, you know, I consumed, of course, a lot of media coverage. I also consumed a lot of interviews that policy experts and others did within the administration. For example, if I knew I was going to be talking quite a bit about Ukraine, I would read interviews that Secretary Blinken had done, that Secretary Austin had done, that Jake Sullivan had done as well. I also read the briefings from, in moments like that, Department of Defense and the State Department. And then I would really try to draw from meetings I had inside of the building in the morning before I did the briefing. I would often walk around with a note card that had kind of the key questions that I thought I would get and try to pose them in some of these meetings to see if I could help add greater context or greater meat to some of the answers that I would provide. But I also worked with an amazing group of the press team, and they would help put together answers based on the policy experts as well. So a lot of reading, a lot of asking questions and pushing internally the system, and a lot of writing, honestly, trying to write out my own answers if I didn't feel like what I was articulating was quite right.
One of the things that you shared in the book is that one of your favorite ways to connect with people, especially people across divides, was to present yourself as flawed or to be honest about your flaws. Why was that an effective way to bridge divides?
Because I think that it lowers the barrier for entry for people. So sometimes when I meet people, not always, but if I don't know them, they know me from the briefing room, people who have disagree with me politically often think I'm going to debate them or something in the moment. I'm not, typically. And what I find is that it's about staying true to your values and your morals and what you believe. But I also think that conveying to someone, you know, I don't know a lot about what it's like to grow up in kind of like rural America. Tell me more about it. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what some of the challenges are and why that would lead you to support Trump or somebody else. Part of it is also asking questions, and I think you can also learn a lot from it, but I think it invites people to engage where they may not otherwise be interested in engaging. So we're all imperfect. I'm certainly imperfect, and so presenting myself as that is not it's an easy thing to do. But I also think it makes people feel comfortable having a real conversation with you about things that they might disagree with you on, or they may have a contradictory view about, or maybe they're just they feel uncomfortable talking to you. So that's why I think it's important.
Well, Ron, this listener wants to know specifically, how do you recommend communicating about the prosecutions of Trump and Hunter Biden and the politics that surround them? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, Ron, a good question. I don't know who you're communicating with. So, like, if it's your cousin who strongly disagrees, I don't know if, like, I would recommend having a debate about it at the dinner table. Maybe. But I would say that the place to always start is the facts. And in this case, the facts are that in the case of the Manhattan trial, it was 12 jurors, everyday Americans, who made the decision that Trump was guilty on 34 counts. It was not Joe Biden. It was not the Department of Justice. It was 12 everyday Americans who sat through 6 weeks of testimony, 6 weeks of documents being presented. There was only one of them who the Trump team objected to. But the most important thing is this is people participating in their civic duty. I mean, as it relates to Hunter Biden, I think what is telling here is if the Department of Justice was rigged, as Donald Trump suggests, would there be a Department of Justice case that Hunter Biden was currently sitting in a courtroom about, the president's son? That doesn't seem like it would be happening. The politics of it is a different, bigger question. I think it's a little early to know at this point, although we've seen some polls, but it's a little early to know what the impact will be of the Trump convictions. Again, as I said earlier, obviously you don't want to run as a convicted felon. So anyone who suggests it's good for him, I don't totally understand. He's raised a lot of money, though, from it. But I think it is something that if people digest it, it's not going to sit well. But what the percentages are, I don't think we know yet. And part of it, I think, is connecting it to people, and this is incumbent upon the Biden campaign, to how it would impact their lives. As it relates to Hunter Biden, we'll see what a trial, how it impacts people, and there's another one in September. It hasn't shown to impact people to date, in part because he doesn't work in the White House. He doesn't work in government. He's not trying to be president or trying to be a part of the White House. This is the president's son who had a well-known drug addiction that many Americans struggle with or have family members who struggle with it. I don't know if that's why it hasn't shown up in the polls, but that's a true part of the story. But there are going to be two shorter trials that play out where Hunter will be a part of it between now and November. So I guess we'll see if there's a different impact over time.
I'm so curious what you think about the next big major communication moment between President Biden and former President Trump, which is expected to be the debate on June 27th. Now, First, I heard that you told Pod Save America last night that you're still a skeptic when it comes to whether or not that will happen. Do you still feel that way?
Well, when it was first announced, this was a couple of weeks ago, I was a little skeptical because there are a set of terms, and I thought this was smart how they did it, that the Biden team put out there when they announced they were participating, including that the microphones would be cut off and a couple of other things. You can't have a real debate with Trump without rules, right? And it was going to be hard for the Presidential Commission to actually put in place real rules. So they put out this set of rules. So the reason I was skeptical is because and still a slight bit, is because Trump has backed out of debates before. And so I maybe I'm less skeptical because it's still happening, but I'm not 100% it's for sure going to happen because he's backed out before. So that's where that came from.
But he did agree to the rules. And do you feel like the rules will help to have a debate that is at least somewhat substantive or helpful for the American people to be able to make a decision about how they want to vote?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to know if the debate will help the American people, right, until we see what the substance of it is. And, you know, I think the people who are going to be moderating the debate are very experienced and smart and tough, and I have no question are preparing a lot for this debate. So I think that's would be their objective too, right? Their objectives as well. I think debates are a moment where the public can tune in and sort of see. And it's about substance in part, of course, which it should be. It's also about feel and how these people make them feel. So some of that is what you have to think about if you're the Biden team and certainly the Trump team too. I mean, it would be Joe Biden could go out there and wear a convicted felon t-shirt and just yell, "You're a convicted felon," at Trump. I don't think he's going to do that. It's not his style. And I also don't think it would be constructive because the American public is looking for more than that. They want to know kind of what are you going to do for me, of course, because they're electing one of these people to lead them. So what does your leadership in the Oval Office mean for my bank account? What does it mean for my rights as it relates to abortion rights? What does it mean for our climate? What does it mean for a range of things? And it is important that they get to that, which the moderators will want to, and I think President Biden will want to as well in the debate.
Yeah, but you're right. The jury's out, not to use that as a pun. But anyway, if you were advising Biden on how to be at the debate, right, how to be during it, because you have described yourself as a huge prepper, Biden is a big prepper, how would you advise him if you were in that position on how to be during the debate?
Well, and I would also say Ron Klain, who's overseeing debate prep, there's no one better at prepping candidates for debates, and he is taking a leave from his job to do this, so that is a massive public service right there. But he also loves the president, I know, so I'm sure it wasn't a hard call for him. You know, I think that, again, just to go back to, it's how you make people feel. And I think for President Biden, your North Star is you want people to feel you're up for the job, that they understand the choice here in the election, and that is about a range of things, right? Yes, it's about the other guy is a convicted felon, but it's also about President Biden, somebody who's going to defend my rights to make choices about my own body, my rights to make choices about my own health care, my rights to participate in the democratic process. It's beyond that, but that's part of it. And the third is kind of, who do you think is fighting for you? And for Joe Biden, you want people to think, that guy's going to fight for me, and the other guy isn't. It's more complicated than that, but I think it's about the feeling you give people. And then you want a couple of viral moments, or even one is good, because these candidates are going to want to raise money, and they're also going to want to engage and excite their base. And for President Biden, that's important. So you have to think about what is the line or two you're going to have on the convictions or something else that's certainly going to engage the base, so that is something that pops from the debate, in addition to the broader feeling people get from watching you make the arguments about the choice and how you are a better alternative to the other guy.
We're talking with former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, host of Inside with Jen Psaki on MSNBC. And let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Nina Kim. Let me go to caller Cynthia in Oakland. Hi, Cynthia, you're on.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, Jen has talked about it, the importance of, as I understanding, setting a tone in the audience, as opposed to just perhaps giving information out. And my second point was, my question was, I believe that Trump has, because of what I'm going to describe as propaganda, has really undermined the American confidence in our democratic institutions. And that really threatens democracy. So if she could, Jen, if you could address those, if that's possible.
And yeah, and I mean, I'm...
thank you for the great job.
Oh, no, go ahead. Keep going.
In both.
Thank you so much for that. I mean, I'm so stuck on your second question that now I'm like, I'm worried I'm going to forget the first and Mina's going to remind me. But the second one I think is so important because the undermining of our systems and our democracy and honestly, Trump's reaction to the verdict, that piece should not be lost on how dangerous that is and how much that is undermining our democracy because he's essentially going after the very system of a jury of everyday men and women who are serving in our Justice Department, of the process that just happened, that just took place over the last 6 weeks, that's a fundamental of kind of who we are as a country. That is part of undermining. And going after witnesses and the judge and the jury, that is undermining too. And so that danger, I think, is a big part of, it's not the only argument, but I think it's a big part of the argument of why a Trump second term would be so bad for our society and for our institutions and for our democracy. There also, I would say, I mean, the Heritage Foundation has the nearly 1,000-page Project 2025 plan on there that goes much more detailed than we will go in this call, but about all of the things he wants to do, including kind of taking over the Justice Department. And you know what that means? That means that he can do no wrong. He could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and nobody could come after him because he owns the Justice Department. He can pardon anyone he wants, including people who do political favors. And these are things that I think are important, not because they're the only things in this election, but are important for people to hear. And now, Mina, now I did forget the first question because I was so passionate about the second.
Yeah, but it was mainly just addressing tone setting with an audience and how you do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think tone setting means, you know, being tough and certainly calling out people's inaccuracies or hypocrisies, but not coming into a conversation telling someone everything you know or arguing at them, because that's just not the way to have an effective engagement.
Yeah.
You may get there, but that's part of it, I think.
So much of your advice in the book, and you acknowledge this as well, actually runs counter to the way we tend to interact in the present moment, I think was the way that you put it, because so much of it, as you're describing, is in-person communication. And we really do a lot less of that these days with our phones, with social media, even with the fact that we are not in our workplaces 5 days a week sometimes or 6 days a week, depending on the type of role that you have. So how do we address that? Because I imagine that has meant that our in-person interactions have atrophied to some degree, you know?
Yes. You know, and it's not always possible, and I'll acknowledge that. I mean, we're having this conversation on the phone, and we're not in the same place, right? Talking to grandparents, there's all sorts of reasons why it's not always possible. But I do think that harder conversations are always better in person. And one of the things I often say to people who are earlier in their careers than I am is there's a huge benefit to working from home. I'm not begrudging that. But I think that sometimes there's a loss from it because you aren't around people who you can learn from, who you can just sit with, who you can observe in the same way. And it also means that even as a manager, and I mean this in a workplace, I guess, of course, you don't have the opportunity to have as many conversations to provide or receive feedback in a forum in person. So I know it's not always possible, and all sorts of companies and organizations are national and global, and that's a wonderful thing. But I do think that there can be a loss from, and there is an atrophying of in-person conversations, especially when people are engaging so much on online forums and platforms. You know, I kind of miss the dating app age because my husband and I have been married for 14 years, and that can be a good thing. I know many people have met their spouses through that, but sometimes I also think it means people don't know how to ask somebody out in person, right? So, and magnify that to workplaces and to friendships and to the ability to have those harder conversations, which I do think there's an atrophying of the ability to do.
Yeah. And also there's the generational issue, too. And of course, the generational divide has come up, especially around communicating the issues related to the war on Gaza and so many other. And we unfortunately are really at the end of that. But I don't know if you have a thought on that as well. We have about 35 seconds, I would say.
I will do my best on communicating around Gaza.
And also with the fact that it really seems to have created a stark generational and in some cases community divides as well.
Yes, I will just say briefly that one of the challenges is that it's not possible to communicate about such a big, important, difficult issue in 30-second sound bites that often are the forum on social media platforms, because there's decades of history, because there's pain in Israel from the events of October 7th, because there is humanitarian devastation in Gaza, because there are many things happening at the same time. And I don't have a solution to that other than to say that discussion is probably better than 30-second sound bites, especially on issues that are as heart-wrenching and difficult as that one.
Noel writes, Joe Biden should campaign along the lines of Reagan's Morning in America strategy. Focus on the positive. Focus on hope. Focus on bringing the noise down. Well, Jen Psaki, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for coming on Forum.
My pleasure, Mina. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking to you, too.
The book is Say More, Work, The White House in the World. Caroline Smith produced today's segment. Thank you, listeners, for your questions and comments. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanic